Hello and welcome to the LRM podcast, sponsored by Adrian Flux Insurance. I'm Martin Dominey.
And I'm Steve Miller.
And we've got two guests on today. We've got Greg King, previous guest of the podcast, almost a year ago to the day.
Yeah, it is.
And also our friend Ian Arthur from Howden Classic. Got it right that time.
Take two.
It's a bit cosy on here with four of us.
I honestly don't think we've had four people. No, we would have done a billing when we had multiple guests on, but this is definitely the most action the salmon sofa has seen down in its...
As we've already alluded to,
it looks like it has seen a bit of action as well. dragged around all the shows as well.
From billing in it.
It's in for a shock this year because it's going to be up and down the country.
Yeah, I think you could vax it or something. Yeah, it's not really looking salmon anymore. It's all brown.
It retains its charm. Yeah.
Just don't sit down too quickly because you'll be engulfed in some dust from billing. Seriously, I think it was that end. I'm on the clean end.
Oh, thanks. thanks, Steve.
First of all,
it is dusty.
If you're new to the podcast, welcome along. Yeah. I don't know. You're probably thinking, what on earth have I tuned into? But no. We're still picking up new listeners, and we love to see it. So thank you. If you're new to the LRM podcast, if you are, go back to the beginning and listen all the way through, and you'll learn the sort of lore of the salmon sofa. But it's going to be, if you're coming to LRM Live in May, the Billing Off Road Show in June, or our brand new Land Rover Fest in July, the salmon sofa will be there, and you can take pictures on it and add to the patina that it's picking up.
There's actually a hashtag. I mean, Greg's even got the t-shirt.
Save the salmon sofa.
Yeah, you had a custom t-shirt.
I don't know where that even came from, the whole save the salmon sofa, because as you pointed out at the time, it was never at risk. I forget who tagged it, but it sort of just became a thing.
The only thing this is at risk at is from the fashion police.
The fashion police, like... and possibly hazardous waste, maybe.
it is of a period, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so heavy as well. Because it's almost like a cinema type thing, isn't it? Like,
part of me wants to know where the origin of this, like, what was it ordered for, and part of me doesn't want to know that at all.
No, I don't know what it was for, but anyway. It's like an oval,
so anyway, it's, if you tuned into the sofa announcement, cars
sponsored by some large furniture company,
inevitably it'll have a sale on.
So the reason, anyway, we digress, and we've not even got into the meat of anything yet. We thought who better to get on than Greg. Obviously, you've had a long and illustrious career at JLR, and you were around when the Defender went out of production.
Yeah.
Which is almost 10 years ago to this day.
Well, from when the podcast goes out, I think it's the following day. Thursday the 29th of January marks the 10th anniversary since the last Defender rolled off the line. And I can't get my head around that. I think it just shows that I'm getting really old, because I just can't believe it's been 10 years. And you were there as well, weren't you?
I was there, but I didn't know you then.
No. I think I knew Patrick, but we hadn't really met. So I think I'd spoke to Patrick briefly during the day. But...
Yeah, so Pat being our old editor. So when we got the invite from JLR, I was like, really? What, we're going to be there? It was an amazing day, because it started really early. Because they weren't going to sort of halt the production line.
No.
So I think we had to be there at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I think the lines start at 7:30, so you would have been obviously tasked to be lineside by 7:30 in the morning, which, if you've driven halfway across the country, is quite an early start.
Yeah, but we had to, the coffee and the croissants.
Oh, of course you did.
And we were treated like, absolute guests.
Was it a 12-hour production line? When you say starts at 7:30, see, I'm sure many listeners will think about car production being almost 24 hours, albeit over shift. So was Defender built as, a daytime project, or?
At the end, it was on days. So they ran for 7:30 till 4, I think, or certainly around then. It was just on single day shift. But it did vary over the time. I mean, I remember when Wolves were being produced, when they did the batch of the Defender XDs in 98, they were certainly running on two shifts. They may have even been running on three for a time. But yeah, I mean, instantly you're doubling your daily production output then. So it did ebb and flow. I think the one thing was, actually, Defender production was supposed to finish in December. And it was purely because of the order bank that they'd got. And obviously everyone putting in their final orders, that they appealed to Ford who supplied the Puma engine, and they agreed effectively a month's extra supply, which is why it was the end of January. Because obviously, you know, whatever it was, say it was 400 or 500 units a week, you know, it was another sort of 2,000 cars that they'd, you know, to try and sell out the order bank.
So if Land Rover had taken DFS's business model of constantly closing down, constantly ending Defender, they'd probably still be making it now.
But did they, was it a case they stopped producing them because, you know, the orders weren't coming in fast enough? Or was it a case where they stopped producing them because a memo went out to dealers to say no more orders from the following day?
I think it had been steady. I think certainly through when 2.2 went in, which was 2012 model year, 12, 13, 14, 15, it was actually pretty healthy figures. You have a look, they were producing more Defenders then than they were certainly in the kind of late 80s when they were doing Turbo D and whatnot. It was a pretty reasonable volume. And I think it was, as you say, the announcement went out, and of course it caused a spike in orders, you know, as well as, you know, for example, Charlie Fawcett of Twisted and whatnot placing an order for 250. You've got dealers appealing to their customers saying, look, you've been a repeat Defender customer, this is your last opportunity. So it would have driven an awful lot. And I think, you know, I think people suddenly remembered how close Defender was to their hearts, if you know what I mean.
It's the same thing, isn't it? If you take something away from somebody, they want it more. If I could kind of go back 10 years, I would have done everything I could have to have bought one new.
So when
I really wish I had.
When I was on the verge of leaving the dealer, which was in 2015, to start a different career path on LRO, before I left, I was offered the X Demo 90. It was Keswick Green, hardtop, no toys on it at all, steel wheels.
How much?
$21,000 And I was like, if I'd have stayed in the dealer and I knew I was going to have, because I took a big pay cut to go into my next job.
Yeah. Welcome to publishing, mate.
And it hasn't recovered since. But had I stayed and had that security, I would have definitely gone in and said, sign me up. And
well, the ironic thing is, if you'd parked that in the garage and not used it, that would be a $50,000 car.
Oh, I know. It's mad, isn't it?
I wonder how many more people would have done the same. Like, you would have just been mad. But then they never charged more, did they? They just seemed to charge the same price.
That I mean, there was some uplift on the end. Don't forget, they did the Autobiography, the Adventure, and the Heritage Editions. And Autobiography was the most expensive Defender ever offered.
Which,
and it
was
up at $59,995, I think. I think it was $61,000 if you had the special paint.
Sounds almost cheap now.
I know.
Then you think, wow, now it's
I mean, I was in SVO at the time, and the guy who ran SVO, John, forgotten his surname, he'll come back to me. Anyway, who was head of SVO, I think there was a big debate on can we actually, you know, in terms of price point, are we being unrealistic? But actually, you know, Adventures, I think, sold out, Autobiography sold out, Heritage certainly sold out. But you look at the values now, you look back at them, you go, well, they were cheap.
If you purchased one, you know, if Martin purchased that one back in 2015, 2016, and I know you and I have had this conversation before, would you put it in a garage, or would you go and turn the key and just enjoy it?
So at the time, when this opportunity was presented to me, and I'm only talking on a personal level, I would have had to have used it because A, I didn't have anywhere to keep it.
Yeah.
And B, I was using Defenders as daily drivers back then anyway. So I would have sold what I had at the time, which was, I can't remember what I had at the time actually back then. I had a 110 county station wagon. Mm. That would
good
have
car,
gone.
Martin. Good car. Very, good choice, sir.
Mine didn't have a front smashed in.
Hey, neither does Ian's now.
Neither does mine now, sir. Thank you.
No, that's a good point. But that
we'll get on to that in a minute, shall we?
Yeah. We've got a bit to go
we'll
at.
Touch on that.
Ian looks like he's warmed up a bit.
that would have had to go.
Yeah.
And I would have had to have daily driven it. But it was still one of the last ones. It would have been on a 15 or a 16 plate. Do you know what I mean? Like, it still would have had some value to it. Realistically, when I'd have got more space, I probably would have mothballed it somewhere and then got a little car to use as a runner back and forth to work. But who knows?
I mean, I see quite a number of late Defenders which have been purchased for investment, which is what they were purchased for, and they've done very low miles. And that's interesting. but I'm more interested in the one that's got a really good story behind it.
Mm.
And you know, not just necessarily the one that's gone around the world or anything like that, but the one that has got a good bit of family history to it or something like that. And in a way, I don't really look at the odometer. I mean, I can't think of when I've looked at buying a Defender, I've ever considered how many miles it's done.
Mm.
I know, it's almost exempt. Greg's looking at me.
Yeah. Greg's looking at me slightly.
No. I think I'm sat here just feeling, not guilty is the wrong word, but you know, I've done both. So if you remember, I bought an ex, I think it was a Royal and Diplomatic 300 mile Puma, and I remember talking to my wife going, "Oh, I'll use it. She went, "No, you won't. It'll just sit in the garage." She was right. It's fine. I mean, to be honest, but I think to have something that you use as a daily, and I think we touched on this last time I was here, to not be precious about it and use it, you'll get far more fun out of it than something that is like a bit of a, you know, trailer queen. And, you know, you just, because it's a lovely thing to have. And if you have got the means to have a large car collection, that's great. You can have some cars like that. But I think you're absolutely right. Use it and enjoy it. Because at the end of the day, almost mileage is irrelevant on the Defender because everything can be replaced. Everything can be overhauled. It's not like a conventional car.
No, definitely. And in fact, you see quite a few questions on social media of, I'm looking at buying a Defender, what sort of mileage do they start to need loads of work? And the answer is, well, it doesn't really matter because, as you say, they're infinitely rebuildable. You buy on condition and you buy on if it's what you want, if it's the body style and the wheelbase and the spec that you want, you buy it on that rather than has it done over 100k. Yes, it doesn't really matter.
I mean, there's some Defenders running around with absolutely phenomenal mileages on because, you know, they've been rebuilt. You know, they may have had two or three engine rebuilds in their life. It doesn't matter, you know.
Talk to me about engine rebuilds.
Yeah, that's probably a sore point, to be fair.
I'll tell you what, a little update on that, actually. I know we mentioned last week, there was back and forth between myself and the company I bought the engine from. They have actually partially refunded me for it, so fair play to them.
Yep.
Okay. Fair dues.
Only heard this morning, so I think, and it wasn't, as I made clear on my Instagram post, it wasn't a warranty issue because their warranty's 30 days. I spent those 30 days making the engine nice and tarting it up and making it not leak and rebuilding the turbo.
And they have to limit their liability on used parts somewhere, don't they, at the end of the day? And actually, 30 days, the vast majority of people that will buy an engine from a breaker is going to buy that engine because they need an engine there and then.
Yeah.
And that they will have a car waiting for that engine and they would have put it in. And I...
They might have 20 days driving.
Yeah, you know, and it's a gamble, isn't it, with all these things. And again, from that dismantler's point of view, I would imagine they started up, and if it was idling a bit high, they would have started up, the light would have gone out, it wouldn't have been excessively smoking, and I'm sure the vehicle it was in was rotten or something.
Yeah. I think you mentioned last week, you said, oh, it had an oil pressure gauge in, they must have known about it. And I must confess, I listened to that, and I thought, well, actually, maybe, you know, the car comes in, it gets stripped down, you know, it probably gets visually inspected. They probably don't have time to get into that much detail. I don't know.
The sheer volume of parts going through a used, it's difficult, you know, parts. Yeah.
But just out of interest, at any point with the partial refund that they've done with the words, do you know who I am?
No, of course not.
No.
I think it's, as I mentioned last week.
I say that in jest.
Yeah, of course. It's completely irrelevant. And I would never, ever pull that card on anyone.
No, I know you wouldn't.
If I'm actually quite glad that it's... that I ended up with that engine, because if it had gone to someone who'd paid a garage in good faith to fit it, they would then be arguments would be happening over labour costs and whatever else.
Well, I mean,
all I said to them was, I've invested this much in making that engine nice. I want to see some of that back before I then spend more money having the cam bearings done.
Yeah.
I sent them a load of invoices of money I'd spent on it. And I said, this is what I think is reasonable. And he said, I'll check with the MD on Monday. And then this morning email back saying that's fine.
Yeah.
And
that's
it.
I think that's
reasonable.
That's very fair play on their part. I'm pleased with it. I'm annoyed I've had to take the engine back out again, and it's a lot more work than I was expecting. But at the same time, I know it will be good.
Yeah.
And you've had extra content to talk about.
Yeah. There is that. But yeah, Ian, are you happy to have your Defender back now?
Oh, I'm delighted to have my Defender back. So for the listeners, Anwar, I opted to... Defender brakes are obviously quite ancient in their design, so I opted to use a Mercedes CLA to increase my braking efficiency.
Good choice.
How did that go for you?
Oh, for me, it was fine. for the Mercedes, it wasn't so great. So, there's one less Mercedes CLA in the world. And, me and the family, lovely summer's day... dual carriageway, contact with Mercedes, into the back of.
I was away on a walking weekend, and without any context, you sent me a picture of your very poorly looking 110, and yeah, and it was like, oh my goodness me, what's happened? But I know everyone was okay, and that's
oh, we went to the air shaft. We're on our way to Shuttleworth Air Show, and we're all looking forward to it. So once the police had reopened the road, and the 2 15-mile tailback had cleared.
I was on that same road, but going the other way.
Did you,
at the same time, I didn't, I didn't see it, but so, we were within an hour of each other.
Also, it happened on Saturday, so the police took the defender away, and I paid for my air show tickets. There's no point in sitting at home, so might as well. We got home, got in my wife's car, went to Shuttleworth, had a lovely day. Felt a little bit sore, to say the least, the following day, because obviously it was quite a bit of a thump. Mm. And I would say probably this comes back to designer defender. You know, I mean, people that have seen the pictures. Yeah, I did a fair bump of damage to another.
Decent crash.
I've never had an accident in my life. I've now had one. I've ticked that off the box. I'm not going to repeat that experience. And the fact that my Land Rover was repairable without any, when I say major work, and what I mean by that is everything was done with hand tools effectively at home in a single garage, with the exception of Blackbird Industries that sort of checked over the chassis.
Good old Mike.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, again, it's knowing the right people, and that is part of it as well. But just being able to go and pick up the parts. I mean, some of the parts for my Land Rover were, I mean, you know, short arms, deep pockets. Wings are expensive, as I found out.
Well, I mean, you made the choice to go genuine on quite a lot of stuff, didn't you?
And I'm glad I did.
Yeah.
Because what I've now got is my driver's side wing that's new is perfectly straight, and my passenger side wing, which wasn't damaged, has got wavy bits in it, which I now can't unsee. So if you
that was factory standard, probably.
But it is. But
yeah, this is where rebuilds start, though, because you cannot put anything like back that isn't.
Oh, we've all done it. Yeah, we've all done it. And it's kind of mission creep. I mean, the Grey 90 of mine, when I first bought that, legitimately, right, I'm just going to get it back on the road, just tidy it up a bit. And it just gets out of control, depending on how disciplined you are or aren't.
But it's everyone does it. Not the outer skin, but the main body of the wing. I think that's £850 plus the VAT from Land Rover. And I'd surrendered myself to buying that. And then me and Marta were walking around Newbury last year. And what I can only describe as a take-off new wing. Because, I mean, the primer wasn't even disturbed. It's obviously been fitted to a vehicle, but it was perfect in every way.
I didn't know you.
And I walked around, and I was just like, I said to Martha, look, we'll see. It's got to be so cheap that I'm not going to put a new part on my car, if that makes sense. Because everything else is OEM. It's new. Mm. You know, it's. And the guy goes, £80. Oh, really? Right, okay.
This highlights the absolute bargains at lurking at our spares days. I'm telling you, we've got one actually.
That's segues Sunday. Beautifully into this Sunday.
This Sunday. If you're listening to this on the day it goes out, so we'll be there this weekend.
Malvern.
Yeah.
Yes. First one of the year.
You'll be there, won't you, Ian?
All four of us are going to be there.
I am.
Are you coming, Greg?
I am. Yes. Because I have been tasked by my other half to get some stuff out of the garage. So
are you selling stuff?
Yeah, I'm selling stuff.
I'll come and see you.
Yeah. It's not going to be like... Yeah, it's just going to be odds and ends, but...
Yeah,
you know,
this might be some
to be honest,
gold.
Yeah, actually, to be honest,
we could do some inner trading thing, right now.
The
best can
thing about those
junk.
Shows, it's not just the selling. To go down and just have a cup of coffee, a bacon roll, catch up with people you know, and you'll pick up something, even if that's not your main reason for going, it's a brilliant day out. I love going to those.
I've never gone to an LRM spares day with a list to look for something, and I've always ended up getting something I need.
Yeah, you don't know till it's in front of you.
I wasn't looking for that wing because, again, I set myself aside that I was going to buy a new one. And it was, I mean, that wing was perfect. Literally, the guys in the body shop just couldn't be more thankful to me. And I've bought parts for my Range Rover. It's like the original radio for an 83 Range Rover. And you take a bit of a gamble whether it's working or not. It was £10.
Really?
You know, I mean, whether it worked or not was irrelevant at that point because it was going to work. And lo and behold, I've put a battery, you know, put onto a battery, put a speaker to it, and I'm blessed with early 80s sound quality.
Well, the early mirrors that you've got on your 80s Range Rover as well. I remember Phil Bashett was down at Newbury, and you bought one from there.
Still stiff.
Yeah, still stiff. That's always good.
That's what she said.
But no, things like that. I mean, when was the last time you had a new old stock 1980s Range Rover Wingbearer? Yeah. You don't find stuff like that anywhere else.
I lost my passenger, one of the LRM Malvern shows, I lost my passenger door mirror on my Range Rover.
Lost it.
Towing it back. And it fell off on the way back on the trailer. So I'm not entirely sure. Anyhow, it's vanished. And I've been trying to find one, eBay, everything like that. And we're walking around. This was Newbury as well. We were walking around.
I was with you, actually.
And Phil from Dunsfold, I said, Phil, you don't happen to have one of these, do you? And he went, yeah. And he wandered down, moved a couple of bits around, like this. And, of course, he's got this label on it that says, still stiff on it. What's your one for, Phil? £30? Perfect. I mean, it was worth its weight in gold there.
Yeah, but I mean, there are some real bargains to be had down there.
Everyone says to me, I hear this a lot, people say, surely this all just going to dry up. But it kind of doesn't. It kind of like everyone...
I think it just gets recycled. You
accumulate stuff thinking, I'll get that because I need it. Yeah. I mean, I've ended up with, like, I own 3 Lower Dashes now.
I remember that whole lower batch debate.
I feel a deal coming
on
here.
Do you?
Yes.
Are they particularly rotten on the inside or not?
No. No, there's two that are really good.
I think off air there might be a deal struck. Yeah,
obviously, I'll keep the better of the two. But I can't help myself. So when I work at these spares days, I'm still looking for lower dashes because I'm trained to look for them. Weirdly. I don't know why.
I'll be looking for a wing and bumper because I still haven't fixed the Series 3 after its little bump at the Newbury off-road course.
You could straighten that. I mean, come on, I straightened everything on mine. Come on, you should straighten that.
Maybe.
I think with the spares day, though, and you're saying about everything's moving on, you also notice the types of spares are moving on. So where 5 or so years ago you had a lot of Series 1, Series 2 parts, you still have those parts.
They're still there.
But you now have Disco 2, Disco 3 bits popping out, L322 parts popping up in there.
3 Land Rover 1 and 2.
Yeah. So as the Land Rovers are, they're getting newer, but they're getting older, if that makes sense. The parts are now coming into that circle of auto jumble.
I mean, I've often thought, wandering around those events, if you run a Disco 2 or something, actually you can run it really economically because so many of the bits you might need you can buy from, you know, broken spares on the stands.
There's a trader that comes to our show specialised in Discovery 2 bar.
Can we stop talking about making Disco 2s affordable, please?
Why is that then?
Are you going to do a buy?
Well...
He did reveal something in the car, actually.
Have you done a buy?
No, he hasn't.
Hang
but
on.
Is this
a big reveal?
Or it's not a big reveal. It's a friend of mine has a Disco 2, which they stopped using, not because there's anything wrong with it, but because they needed a van for these karting bits of bobs. And then he threatened that he wanted it to go to a good home. And then the other night he said...
So you said, bring it to me.
And then the other night he said... To speed this up, I've transferred the logbook into your name. So
that in sales is an assumptive close.
And it's friends.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. I did say to him,
I've seen a picture of it.
You kind of need a couple of months off not crawling underneath cars.
I do. I'm sure listeners, if you have a warm workshop, it's wonderful. If you have a single garage or you're doing things at home, and it's -3 outside, there's nothing like rebuilding a front swivel on a Defender in -3. It's a truly...
Hang on, the way you describe that to me in the car, you had your heater, you had a kettle, you had a toaster, and then you had all the tools the other side. So you made it like a little hobby hole for you for the day, and you had everything around you.
Working with cold metal is just no fun. No. It's just that moment when you touch something, it almost feels like it's burning you.
Yeah. I have to say... we touched on your Range Rover a little bit earlier, but the engine in, out, the mess, you know, the mess
about
you've
done. You and I are very good taking engines out.
Oh, we are pretty speedy at it now. But doing that in a single garage. I know I pushed the front of my 110 into my shed because it won't fit because the shed's not tall enough. So I can roll around on a wooden floor rather than on gravel. But even like re-chassising the Series 3 we did on gravel, I had the luxury of space around me, whereas a single garage is my idea of hell for working on cars because you just wouldn't.
I'm incredibly fortunate where my neighbours are understanding and tolerant. That's how I put it. I mean, there is obviously...
You provide them entertainment, though. They
I do provide... I mean, there was one afternoon, a summer's evening at 6.30, I decided that we were going to put the body of my mother's Discovery One back onto the rolling chassis on my driveway. And we did it with a series of trolley jacks and four people. And we finished at 12:30 at night. And the following morning, I went around to my neighbours with a load of goodies. I said, look, I'm really sorry for the noise we made. You know, I generally am apologetic. He said, it's the most entertainment I've had for years. He says, I sat watching you guys out the window. And he says, and it was just brilliant. But ever since, not just ever since then, but I was just cautious that I have a lot of space out the front of my house. But what I'm doing in my hobby, I don't want to be disturbing those around me.
You don't want to be that guy.
I don't want to be that guy. And also, again, it's that moment when everything's, if it's in your garage, even if it's tight in that garage, when something goes wrong, even if there's not someone looking at you, if you something goes wrong, you go, yeah. But there's no one looking at you, so you can just say all the words you want under the sun.
There's a big difference between knowing that you're noisy and alerting people and being aware of it and being a bit apologetic and just being one of those people who is just so horribly oblivious to the fact there's other people in the world.
Yeah. I think that's it. Some people, it just doesn't dawn on them, does it?
Yeah. No, and again, I'm really fortunate to say, if you ever consider putting a Discovery One body shell with glass in the interior back onto a rolling chassis on your driveway, that's, don't.
Yeah, yeah. That's quite
Ian's top tip.
Just don't do it.
Don't do it.
No, don't do it.
We're proud to partner with Adrian Flux, the UK's largest specialist motor insurance broker. If you're looking for Land Rover insurance, they should be your first stop. They even offer up to 15% off your premium for Owners Club members. Just call them directly on 0344 728 0417 for a quote and let them know you belong to an Owners Club to get a great deal.
Should we get back onto Defender? Because I know we've deviated quite a lot here. So, Greg.
That's unusual on your podcast.
I know, it never happens. We haven't started talking about McDonald's or meal deals yet, so that's all Yorkshire puddings. But, I'll tell you what, actually, yesterday, I had a Yorkshire pudding at the pub. We went out for pub lunch with my other half and her parents, my in-laws, and it was a cracking meal. But the Yorkshire puddings were, like, enormous, and they were quite daunting looking, but they were really, really, like, cut, like,
what are you really talking about?
A daunting,
you can't beat a good
honestly.
Yorkshire
it took up about a third of the plate, and you cut into it, and it was totally hollow, it was pointless. So, I didn't eat it. Anyway, Defender. Yes, so you obviously you were about at Land Rover when these final editions came around. What do you, how involved were you, and what was like the thought process behind those three different models, and what was your involvement?
So I was in SVO when Defender was ending. Actually, although no one knew at the time, hidden away in the engineering workshop, only a few rows over from where Defender production line was, the first Land Rover Reborn, the Series 1 restoration, was just been started, and it was just being done, but it hadn't been revealed because there was going to be some continuation on Defender. But at the time I was in SVO, and I'd been working on Defender Autobiography, because initially Defender Autobiography was going to be launched a little bit earlier than the other two editions, and then I think sales and marketing made the decision that they were going to bring the three editions together. So effectively, I think Adventure and Heritage were done through sort of core SVO, and then Autobiography was done through Bespoke. So that's why I remember the pricing and things, because, I was sort of quite involved with that. But I think there was recognition that there needed to be a bit of celebration for the final Defender. And as I say, you know, I remember that there definitely was a marked spike in orders for that reason, and not just for those additions. You know, you had the farmers, you had the landowners, you had people that were staunch Defender customers, and you know, in some instances, I mean, our family are good friends with the Young family, Roger Young, down in Salt Ash, and you know, there were Defender customers that maybe had 20 Defenders and you know, 90s and 110s and series before that, repeated, you know, every 3 years they got a new Defender. So of course they all, even if they weren't due to have a new one, did, because they wanted the last one to last as long as it possibly could. With no one at that time knowing what new Defender was going to be, because obviously there was a gap between the two. Mm. But no, I mean, the thing it's a real kind of bittersweet time for me, because it was very sad the production ended. And obviously new Defender was never going to be the same as old Defender, because it couldn't, because of legislative reasons and everything else. But that final day, and I'm sure Steve will agree, it was the most amazing atmosphere. It was the most incredible day.
It really was, and the reality of it was this: the guys were still building these cars, so that the last ones weren't finished, were they? They didn't stage it.
No,
that was a continuation of the day before. Yeah.
They decided what the last few were going to be, obviously.
Yeah, of course, lining them up accordingly.
I remember Kim Palmer, who was UK head of PR at the time, and Tracy Thompson, who's still at JLR as head of PR now, actually, and. They had lists of the final cars and the specs and whatnot. And so everyone kind of knew quite widely within the business what they were going to be. But yeah, but I mean, on the lead up to that, you know, there were just, you know, there. For example, I remember looking at a 110 high cap, and I remember thinking to myself, I wonder if that's the last 110 high cap ever going to be produced, because obviously there were so many variants. It's not just the final Defender, you know, you'd have the final 90 pickup, the final 90 hardtop, the final 110 hardtop, the final high cap, the final 130. And, you know, a customer somewhere has got a January build of that spec of car, and they probably don't know, but that will be the last of that derivative.
Of course, yeah.
It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Here's a question then. The guys actually working on the production line, were they in those roles all the time, or were they chosen because it was media?
Like no, absolutely everyone on that line, that was their normal job. And I'd known a lot of those guys for many, many, many years, because a lot of the guys on Defender had been there for a long time, and that was their normal roles. There was no staging there. That was a normal day in production. The guy that drove it off the line was the guy that drove all of them off the line.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there were no changes, but it was always quite a good atmosphere on Defender line. The guys and girls were fantastic. But that last day, it was just amazing. It was so positive.
I always remember there were two people. I can't remember their names, but I remember one guy stood there with a ratchet. And I thought, what? I don't know why, in my mind, he's thinking like a robot will come along and do that nut and bolt up. No.
On Defender?
I know, but in your mind, you don't really think about it. You don't often see things like this.
I think the difficulty with that is in modern times, cars are described as hand-built or hand-finished, and they're not. They're machine-built, and then someone screws the badge on. Defender actually wasn't it, for the most part?
Absolutely.
There was some minor adjustment with a hammer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was. I can't remember what they were fitting, but there was some, you know, manipulation.
Everything, Steve. Everything.
This is mad. And there wasn't millions of people there.
But if you went back, if you were to look at footage or, you know, pictures from on a Series 3, you'll probably find that the door fit was done in exactly the same way 40 years before that. You know, it was, the car evolved. You know, I'm sure, because often I remember, funnily enough, wandering round on that last day and thinking, actually, someone who was on the line on 1948, this wouldn't be alien to them. It would still be all recognisable in terms of process.
It's mind-blowing, isn't it? I, again, like I said before, I was obviously too early on in my media career to go along, but I was so jealous that Mike Goodbun got to go, my then editor. I was like, oh, that'd be so cool. Now he works at SVR, I believe.
He does, yeah.
Nice chap.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, the actual...
I left JLR in 2019, but funny enough, I bumped into him just the other day. I was at Classic for a reason, and he happened to be there and popped out, because I think he was hot desking, so it was lovely to catch up with him. So.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I've got a lot of time for Mike.
I remember the vehicles that were going down the line and looking behind, and there was nothing behind it. It was like a vastness and like a bit of a haze.
Wasn't it odd?
Very, very odd. And there was an emotion in the air as well for people, because it was a celebration but also a sad day.
I can imagine.
It was almost like the funeral of a Defender, wasn't it? Like there's a...
The celebration.
But the wake was afterwards. Yeah. So it was almost like you were at the ceremony of it. And it was a celebration of it, of its life, but a celebration of the end.
Anyone that knows me knows that I've been a massive Defender geek my whole life. That's no... And my boss at the time, Kevin Walsh, who I'm still great friends with now, basically on that day when Greg, I'm not going to see you today. Just do what you need to do. And that was brilliant. And as a result of that, it wasn't planned at all, but I ended up just in the right place at the right time and ended up driving on the cavalcade between Solihull down to the One Show, BBC One Show in the evening.
Yeah, lovely.
The whole day was amazing. And because it had been on the radio all day, it had been on the news all day, were driving down the M40 and everyone was tooting and waving at this I forget how many they were, but sort of a dozen Land Rovers going down the M40, you know, right from the very beginning to the final production car.
On that day, Pat, our old editor Pat, he got asked to go on to Sky News. Yes, so he was interviewing Sky News.
He's by the gate, wasn't
and
he?
Then they were asking him questions live. Like, this is when he was in his, and he won't mind me saying, this is when he was like country gent phase of fashion. So he had his barber jacket and a flat cap.
It's a fashion you've never got out of. Yeah.
All right. And he
was playing as a farmer.
Yeah. I'm a fake farmer. Yeah. But so there you were asking him questions about the economic state of Land Rover. And he was like, I've listened to that interview back since. Mm. And he did answer it very well. I know if I was put on that same spot, I wouldn't have been able to answer the question.
Yes, it wasn't really phrased as a talking to an enthusiast. It was more about all of the business impacts of Defender finishing.
But
I think he coped very well, bearing in mind he was really put on the spot.
Really on the spot. Imagine that the whole world is watching you. It's like, wow.
Fair play to him.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Flat cap off to him. You know. I remember driving out of the factory because there was like a lineup of Land Rovers to drive out.
Yeah.
So I drove a lightweight out of the Macula. Beautiful.
Yeah. It was a horrible feeling, even someone who wasn't there. Like, it genuinely felt like someone died.
Yeah.
It was a real sadness. Like, the actual, it felt like, do you know, I don't get sad about, it sounds awful, I don't get sad about celebrities dying, to be honest, but I was really sad when Ozzy Osbourne died, because he's always been there and you expect him to always be there.
Yeah.
Defender was the same. It was such a constant through my entire life, and it was just like, oh, it's Land Rover, isn't it?
It's not just a car, though. When they run off, I don't know, but when the last Nissan Qashqai comes off the production line, who cares?
No.
But no one cares. It's an appliance.
Yeah.
Whereas this is a...
I mean, the only one modern car that caught my attention lately was, I think, the Ford Focus ended.
Mm.
And that was announced. I remember thinking, well, now it's all EV and the traditional sort of light cars are finished. But with Defender, as you say, it was such a big thing. And I think there were so many people within the business that were true, and I mean really true, Defender fans. It really did make the event fantastic because everyone pulled together, and actually the event that came out of it was really did honour the car in the way.
It's probably a natural because of the feeling that everyone had at the time for it, and that you were all in awe of the fact that we had been invited almost.
Mm.
Here's a question, Greg. What did the people who worked on Defender line go on to do? Did they get other jobs in the business?
So, I mentioned Land Rover Reborn earlier, the restoration of the Series 1 programme. There were basically, out of those guys that have finished, a few were select, and it couldn't be that many because obviously there were, you know, I forget how many people, but hypothetically, let's say there were 200 people that worked on the production line. There was a small amount, there was about a dozen guys that went over to the Reborn programme.
Right.
And that, first of all, was actually done at Solihull site. In the early days, you could, as part of the Land Rover experience visits, you could go round the restoration workshop at Solihull.
Okay.
And then we then all moved over to a dedicated facility in Wrighton, which is where Classic is today. So some of those guys and girls moved over to that. Others went on to other production lines within, you know, they might have moved on to, you know, building Villa or whatever. And there were actually quite a few that had decided to stay on and take retirement when Defender finished. So that was the last thing they worked on.
Wow.
And there was quite a few as well. Because, you know, there were a lot of people that had, you know, literally had spent maybe 30, years plus working on Defender, you know, really, really experienced guys.
Well, I suppose it's a natural end if you were thinking of getting to the
And I think people had hung on.
Retirement age,
to, I'll wait until Defender finishes.
See it out.
Really
see the job out.
I mean, it was the most fantastic atmosphere, and you could never repeat it. You could never repeat it.
Apart from obviously being a mode of transport, what impact do you think, we'll go round the sofa, what impact, be it social or global, do you think Landro's had, the biggest impact it's had, that Defender's had? Because again, I think if you ask anyone in the world, draw a car, that's a silhouette you're going to get. Be it, you know, you will get that generic Defender silhouette.
From a basic young age, from a child, they'll draw a square box, wouldn't they? With four wheels.
I think what surprises me is where Land Rovers, series or Defenders, but anything like your traditional square Land Rover, where they pop up.
Yeah.
You'll be watching a documentary or a TV programme or even like a fictional, like a drama or a comedy. You know, there's a Land Rover there. Oh, look at that, a Defender there.
They're everywhere for me. So I was giving someone a lift the other day and she sat there and she went, they're rare, these Land Rovers, aren't they? And I literally just glanced in my mirror and there's another one behind me. I think it depends where you live in the world, doesn't it? But I mean, you know, for us, it's, you know, there's seven in our village, you know, and they're all long-term ownership. You know, there's no new purchases. They own one, and be it a 300 TDR or a Puma, they have a Defender. It fulfills that requirement, and therefore there is no need to change it.
There's no replacement for it. What's the point?
No.
You can only get the nearest one you can get is 10 years old.
I mean, I grew up in the southwest and still got friends and family down there, and you go into rural Devon, there's still, you know, so many farmers and you know, people working within the countryside that are still using, you know, TD5s and Pumas, you know, day in, day out as their daily. And
nothing wrong with that, Greg.
Nothing wrong with that at all. But the point is, you know, they will be continued in service for as long as they feasibly can, you know. And I think it's going to be a long, long time before Defenders sort of disappear out from use within, you know, not enthusiasts, but just people that it's the right
fit. Like the British Army. You still see them up and down, you know, running up and down the A1 now, near here, with the Penman Trail on the back. And I can't help myself, but I go, look at that. Well, just love seeing them.
And Wolves were all produced in 97,
98. Yeah, they're getting on.
And I don't know when they're planning on keeping them in service to. But you think about it, they're now, what, 27, 28 years old. And they're still, you know, in service, doing all of, you know...
Because there's nothing to replace it with. No. You don't see a Grenadier go up the road with a Penman Trail on the back, do you? Or,
no.
I like your Penman Trailer, don't you, Steve?
I love a Penman Trailer.
he has mentioned that quite a few times.
He has Penman Trailers and tyres.
Ever episode was, and still to this date, most popular episode was about Steve's trailer and us geeking out over tyres.
So you're saying about, you know, the replacement side. Obviously, when I had a slight hiccup with the Defender, my Defender's called Hank the Tank, by my daughter. My daughter's 11. And one of the reasons it was repaired is I was driving, pulled up into the co-op, and not sure what relevance has, but the co-op is where I pulled up into. And I looked on her phone, I went, what's that backdrop on your phone? And she picked up a bit of paint off the road after the accident, and she was going to stick it back on Hank when it came back. Aww. So, of course, Dad swelled up instantly. And it's like most people, or most cars, you look at that damage, I'll go get another one. Yeah. And like for me, it was a case of, no, I'm fixing that one.
Yeah,
that's one of one. You know, absolutely. And it was.
So, had you not done that, your Defender ownership now may have been different.
Well, it might be a DB9, but
well, that practical family car. Yeah.
But easy. It's that moment going. You look at it and just like, oh, I'm going to have that one. And I think also partly when I stripped the front end of mine off and realised that my bulkhead was like new, and actually the front of my chassis wasn't rotten at all. And mine's on 177,000 miles. It's 25 years old. And you look at it, and I just went, actually, if I go and buy another one, what trouble am I going to get myself into? Oh, I'll fix this one, thanks.
Yeah.
And that was it. It was staying again.
I think I remember stripping the front off with you after that had happened and having a look. And I think that's the thing. If you look after a Defender, as you say, what's yours, 20, coming up to 26 years old and 177,000 miles, in really good fettle, because if you look after them, they will go on and on, which goes back to this conversation we were having earlier about almost mileage is irrelevant, because you can rebuild everything on it.
I think a good thing that's come out of the end of Defender production ending is, as years have gone on and people have gained interest in Land Rovers, they've gone, you know, oh, I remember there's this old one that sits in a hedge down the road from my house. I walk past it all the time. And all these vehicles that were once worth next to nothing and they'd been retired because the clutch had gone or they had a rotten footwell and failed MOT. People are putting the time and money into reviving them. There's probably more that have come out of the woodwork since 2015-16 that are being...
That would be an interesting statistic. I think if you were to have a look at the amount that are on sawn or perhaps dropped off the DVA, certainly within the UK on the DVA register, I'm sure you'd find that quite a few have come back in the last few years.
I would say maintenance has also improved. We were talking about this on the way over, and I wouldn't say I religiously changed my oil at 5,000 miles, but around 5,000 miles, the oil is going to come out the bottom of my Defender. And oil is a great thing. Quality oil regularly changed saves an engine, full stop. And every winter, probably about this time of year, I won't need to do it this year because it's barely been on the road, but my Defender gets steam cleaned by one of the truck yards. Give them 20 quid and they send a man under there dressed up in a hazmat suit and he goes under with the steam cleaner.
Where is this place?
And the thing was I think that's part of the reason why it survived so long is the fact that I haven't let all the mud just build up on it. And I think the newer Defenders, especially when you see it, the newer Defenders are maintained and treated like cars. And by that I mean when a clunking noise appears, people tend to address them rather than, we'll all remember, there's a clunking noise there, it's characteristic of the car, so don't they all do that? And actually, that was your swivel joint about to fall apart.
The first Defender I ever had, actually, when I took it for MOT the first time, the guy underneath was like, oh, it's filthy under here, because it had come off a farm. It was all I could afford at the time. It was pretty bad. The MOT tester I knew on the complex of garages that I worked at, and I was like, massive chunks of mud where it had never been cleaned underneath. It had packed in, dried, and you couldn't see anything. And I said, oh, I'm really sorry, mate. I didn't know it was this bad. I'll take it up the top and pressure wash it. He was like, no, don't do that because you don't know what's behind it. Yeah, fair point, actually. But looking after them, any kind of rust treatment, in and out, inside the chassis rails, on the outside, bulkhead footwells, all that stuff. I couldn't believe it when you sent me that picture of your footwell. I was like, you could eat your dinner off it. And it was still shiny.
Greg was there when we stripped it down to see how bad the damage was. And I remember my exact words shortly after we got told that our barbecue was ready. It was the most Ian thing you can imagine. I invited Greg to come over and take my accident damaged car apart and then told him there was a barbecue going. So come on, chop chop, I'm hungry.
Actually, you still owe me a beer. Because I did a parts list for you.
Sounds like a lunchtime beer coming up.
but it's what you needed, if I remember rightly, going through.
But it was that moment where we took it apart and I looked at it and I was like, why couldn't I crash a rusty one? There's thousands of these things out there. Why have I bashed a good one? And at the time, I didn't realise how good it was. And actually, as it came apart, I was like, not only are the bolts coming out and not snapping, I've probably reused them, but the bit they've gone into is still there, you know. And it's like the bulkhead all down the pillars. And again, this car, it's not lived in a garage. It's, you know, it goes to the Isle of Man. It generally is used
as
a family car.
Yeah,
as a family car. But it's just that couple of oil changes, and it's, I mean, one year it did 23,000 miles with me in a year. It's not like it sits there.
So now, Ian, you've done all the work to yours. Do you feel a proper connection, more of a connection to it? That you'll probably keep it forever.
I would say that my daughter crying has changed my opinion of that car. And her excitement when, obviously I had to wait for an MOT, so we had to do some sea trials to make sure that everything worked. And my daughter's excitement when, you know, we went out in it for the first time. But I remember this, what got me into Land Rover was I was brought up with a Series 3 station wagon, ORB 503M, if anyone knows what it is. and my father and my mum also had a V8 county station wagon, which was stolen and recovered once. So, you know, nothing changed, and that would have been in the late, early 90s. And that got me into them. And, you know, the Range Rover I inherited from my grandfather, and again, we restored that, we brought that back to life again. But yeah, no, that Defender now is just, I've got a feeling it's hanging around. But I don't have any need to change it. I can't. I mean, it's not fast, it's uncomfortable, it's cold, it leaks. Sometimes I get to the office and I look like I've wet myself because the door sill leaks. But it's
that is just your age.
But I can't think of, I genuinely can't sit there. And I am fortunate if I do drive some quite cool stuff. And I get out of stuff and go, do you know what? I don't have any desire. I you know, it's noisy and rattly, it slows me down. It just means I don't get a speeding ticket.
That's a good, that you've just said, what, has got you into Land Rovers right at the very beginning, why you have a passion for them. What was your earliest, this is a very valid question, Phil, what was your first interaction with a Land Rover of any description? And that's to both of you, because I'm quite curious.
For me, it was...
Hold on, Greg, whose podcast is
this? No, I just thought it was a really nice question.
It is a nice question, because I always get a warm, fuzzy feeling when I think about this. So my uncle and my granddad ran a logging business, and they had a Series 2A long wheelbase.
Right.
Which was basically a bulkhead,
yeah,
two front wings and an engine, and this hauled the timber out of the woods with V-grip tyres on the back. And on the outriggers was welded on scaffold poles, basically, to hold the...
Oh, wow.
And my job as a 8-year-old, 9-year-old, yeah. I can't remember how old, I was young, was to stand on the seat box with no seat and hold on to the top of the windscreen frame and ride around the woods while my uncle drove this thing.
Yeah. What a memory.
And I've got, there's a picture on my Instagram, actually, if anyone wants to check it out, on Steve Miller Automotive. And there's a picture with a pheasant sitting on the top of it.
Oh, wow.
And this thing lived in the woods. Mm. And they used to have to park it on a stump because the fuel used to drain out the tank on the spits in the tank, and only put a gallon or two in it at a time just
to
use
it below where the crack was.
And this thing would haul timber, and it was built by my uncle Alan and his mate Craig, and it was called the Al Craig, and they promised I'd have it one day, but it actually got stolen out in the woods for the V-grip tyres by a man who I know to this day.
We'll have to go and get it back.
So when he stole the tyres to build an off-roader, he just decided that looked like a scrap Land Rover in the woods, but it was a usable thing. He had to go and apologise to my granddad.
Too right.
Which wouldn't have been an easy thing. Hmm. But that Land Rover for me was the thing. And I knew I was going to have a Land Rover from a very young age.
Hmm. Yeah. Hmm.
And I'll tell you, if I always think about building a replica of Al Craig.
That'd be awesome.
Because you could.
Let's do it.
Yeah. I've got enough pictures. There are enough pictures.
You'd probably get that done before you're 90.
You got there first. Yeah.
I think there were two others going, about to say the same thing.
Why are you three eager to jump on me? Yeah. So yeah, that's my memory. And that will always stick with me.
Yeah. What about you?
Well, I've obviously always loved... I always bought the magazines. But the first proper, I suppose, real life kind of Land Rover experience was when my dad worked. My dad's always worked on farms. Mm. I used to go when I was a kid to count the cattle with him and feed on Saturday and Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And they had an absolutely hanging H-Reg 110 single cab, non-high cap.
Okay.
It was faded pink. It was had cow muck falling off it, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And because obviously when you're counting cattle, you've got to drive all around the fields.
Yeah.
I'd drive and Dad would count, and then we'd get to the field and swap over the edge of the field and swap over. And I couldn't wait to own one.
What sort of age were you out of interest?
I must have been 10.
It's a similar sort of, because for me it's about
that impressionable age, well,
yeah.
Finding the right parts for your Land Rover or Range Rover shouldn't be an off-road challenge. At bmh4x4.com, we've built a smarter way to get you back on track. Our new website is now live, the simple, fast and reliable way to find the parts and accessories you need. Supplying quality parts for Defender 1983 to 2016, Discovery 1, 2, 3 and 4, Range Rover Sport 2005 to 2013 with Range Rover P38A and L322 coming soon. All parts are backed by expert knowledge, quick delivery and a 2-year quality guarantee. Visit bmh4x4.com, built by enthusiasts for enthusiasts.
See, my dad had Volvo Estates. You know, he wasn't really a car man.
No, mine wasn't either. And I think he used to find my interest in this old nail quite weird. But his dream car when I was younger was he always wanted a Discovery, Epsom Green ES Discovery, and he never got it because you know it wasn't on silly money. But I really, really wanted this 110, and it sat in the... They ordered, funnily enough, and one of the when the TD5 was coming to an end, Dad's boss ordered a TD5 high cap.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be... I can't remember what happened, but it was a cancelled order for Environment Agency or something, and he ended up the dealer rang him up and said, we've got this one. Mm. And he said, I don't want a white one. And they painted it Benatti grey, and they've still got it.
Oh, really?
But the old 200 TDI sat in the corner of the yard for years. And I was like, oh, Dad, can you ask if he wants to sell it? And he wouldn't. He was like, you don't want that. It's knackered. And eventually sold it to my mate's cousin. I was very annoyed.
So I've got, I mean, it's going sort of towards the future of Defender. So I've got two children, Olivia that's 11, Nathan is 15. And my like memories of Land Rovers, my late father had old planes. And I remember releasing balloons at Woburn Tiger Moth fly-in. And they used to release balloons from side of planes, used to pop them with their propellers.
Oh, wow.
Brilliant thing. What? And of course, I would have been about 6, 7, 8. I just, you know, hold this mirror, you know, hold this balloon out. My dad would go, release! And you would let it go. And you go, I missed that one. I mean, environmentally, this was just a disaster. Now, but then again, I was sat in a burbling V8 Defender, you know, a V8 110. But I mean, my son learnt to drive, oddly enough, in this blue 110, and again on an old airfield. And I mean, yes, he likes fast cars and things like that, as anyone does. But you go to Nathan, go, what do you want? You know, do you have any interest? Yeah, old Army Land Rover. And he would be quite happy hacking around in an old 90, military 90. Mm. Well, he's not going to get any speeding tickets, is he?
But, no.
He's not. Yeah, he's quite happy. And when you actually speak to, you know, teenagers, they're still cool.
The number I was saying to Steve this just this morning, the number of emails we get predominantly about the podcast are from, and I've like, loads of pictures people send in.
Yeah.
Guys and girls, women in their early 20s that have gone out and got Defenders because they are brilliant and they're cool.
It's a lifestyle thing. I do think, and I won't sort of go too far off track here, but you know, if people are going to have EV Teslas and things in their day-to-day vehicles, these Land Rovers are still going to be around because they're a lifestyle thing as much as ever, where they'll go down the beach and they'll go camping and they'll go things like that. So even if these Defenders do 2,000 miles a year, 3,000 miles a year, it's going to be irrelevant because they are still,
they're still around, aren't they?
Yeah.
But I went to, only briefly, went to Tea on the Tailgate yesterday down in Warwick. And actually, there is an evolving younger Land Rover community. Because actually, I think there was around 100 cars there. And there were quite a lot of, you know, guys and girls in their 20s, you know, with everything from tricked up TD5s to sort of standard series that, you know, because they're not too expensive to insure, they're not too fast, you know, and they're a cool thing. And I think it does seem to be a growing area, actually, that more and more younger people are getting into it.
It was funny. When my mum used to work for a company, and the boss of the company was super into his Land Rovers, and he used to go all over Europe and do, like, off-road rallies, and he had this really cool, it was a TD590 Monte Carlo Blue, really rare spec. It was a pickup Monte Carlo Blue, and it was all modified.
Spec.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, I was really, he used to, where I used to cycle to school, he'd always stop at the shop and get papers or whatever on the way, and I used to like proper perv over this thing. And Mum said, well, if you're that obsessed with it, I'll ask him if he can take it, if he'll take you up the road in it. And I was like, oh yeah, that'd be brilliant. Anyway, we went off around the villages in it, and I was chatting to him, and he goes, you're probably like a bit of a dying breed, you are. And I was like, what are you on about? He said, young people, they don't care about Land Rovers. I was thinking, I hadn't really considered that ever, but all my friends were into like modified cars and that, and I was probably one of two or three in my class that liked off-roading and Land Rovers. And now, of course, that's been completely blown out of the water because, as you've just said, they are like
when I mean in the 1990s. Obviously, you're aware of the Grey 90. I was using that when I first started the apprenticeship at Land Rover. Everyone else was in, you know, they were now on a sort of, they got a wage, they got an income. They were all, you know, angling for, if they weren't in hot hatches, they were going to, or they had, you know, a Fiesta with a big exhaust on and you know, big stereo and bass box, or they had one of the guys had a Renault 5 Turbo, and it was like, wow, and another one had a Peugeot. It wasn't a 205 GTI, it was a 309 GTI, which is a slightly, but really into that. And I was really the odd one out, but I wouldn't be.
We've had this, I know we've said this before, but You're probably from the similar, I don't know what year you were born, but
we're similar age.
Aren't
I'm not
we?
Going to disclose exactly what.
I don't know which one of us has had the tougher paper round, but it feels like me, I think.
I do.
Why are you looking at me? Like that. But it was in this sort of like mid-90s. I was the same. My mates are like Cavalier SRIs and stuff like that. And I was odd in a Series 2A lightweight.
Yeah.
Very odd, 1996.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to start at the start handle because I thought, I don't know, because I just thought I could. And it was just weird.
But you used the start handle to shoo away all the women that were coming over.
All the women that literally turned away. But actually, funnily enough, when I was fairly young, sort of 18-ish, 19, I had a Series 3. And I went out with this girl, my first sort of serious girlfriend, and her dad had an Epson Green Discovery.
Nice.
And a B-Reg 90, which he used to tow his trailer with every day. And I'd go around to pick her up. No mobile phones back then. And I'd go around to pick her up in my Series 3, park outside. And then she'd be, like, getting ready. We'd go to the same pub every night. And I just sit there talking about Land Rovers to him for like a good couple of hours, and he'd had about LRO at the time, and LRM was only new out back then.
Yeah,
and he'd sit there. We'd talk about Land Rovers and talk about the latest article in the magazine, and she'd come down. I'll be ready. Like, yeah, in a minute. We'd just talk Land Rovers for hours, and the only disappointment was splitting up with her at the time was I wouldn't go and see her.
No, I remember mine was known as the mobile chicane because it was always in the if we're out driving together, our mine was always in the way, so overtaking Greg and his mobile chicane.
Yeah. I have to say, I think
Paul saying that.
The don't get me wrong, I've had my Series 3 for coming up 6 years now, and I've done a lot to it, re-chassied it and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and I like using it, but I don't feel the same connection to that as I do the 110, because I never grew up around series stuff. Yeah. Whereas Defender, I know that's a pre-Defender, but that feeling
of the ilk,
the cabin, the whole feel of it, the way they drive, is so ingrained in me that I'm like, this is why I'm so desperate to get this engine finished, because I just want to use it.
What do you think the threats are to Defender going forward?
Threats.
Yeah, threats as in them being
used. Well, you mean as a classic car being used?
I'm supposed to be 10 years old. They're old cars now, aren't they?
I think the threat is the same threat as for anything with an internal combustion engine. I don't think there is any specific threat to a Defender.
But, I mean, I think there will be a large proportion. Those vehicles are going to be in service for a very long period of time. You know, someone that's bought a last-of-the-line Defender will keep it going. So it's quite an interesting thing, isn't it? You know, the pool of vehicles, I think, yes, you'll always have classics, but they are, you know, just come out on the odd Sunday and they're probably very valuable cars. There's very few vehicles that are used day in, day out that are quite an aged portfolio of vehicles, if that makes sense. So I think
one of the biggest
taxation is probably the biggest threat.
I think one of the threat. I'll use the word threat. It's probably good quality parts. Something I say I've had unfortunate experience with. No one ago, but it's just that moment going. It would just be nice just to keep getting good quality parts and not constantly fighting with stuff.
Do you think, obviously for a long time when Defenders were still in production, and even before that when they were being used as weekend off-roaders and green laners and whatever, and there was obviously quite a big hunger for more budget-friendly stuff.
Yeah.
Do you think that now that the time is passing, the years are going by, it's been out of production longer, but people are keeping them and they're treasuring them more, it might be the flip side and better quality stuff will come out?
I think there's people far more... people willing to put quite strong money into replacement parts and upgrades because they're planning on keeping the car. Because there are so many great manufacturers of accessories and parts now that didn't exist a few years ago.
More so now.
I mean, my day with, you know, some of the investment that companies are making now on you know, parts and accessories and things that 20 years ago just it didn't exist at that level. I mean, it did exist, but it was a much smaller customer base. I think now there's a much bigger, you know, as we said with Defender values, you know, to buy anything decent, you are putting serious money down to buy something. So, you know, you buy better stuff.
And I think that's saying, you know, it's worth companies investing in that tooling because that, you know, there is another generation coming in, and I would say that generation probably has higher expectations of a vehicle than we do. You know, where we generally are used to slamming that door because a stupid thing won't line up ever.
It's not a case of a gap in the door. You expect a gap in the door, but the width of the gap differs now. People don't, they expect an airtight cabin and a Defender and leather seats and no water ingress. I mean, what's all that about?
It is interesting. I think the thing to remember, and I know we've talked about the end of it and where we think it's going and what Defender means to us, but it's not going anywhere really. And I think, you know, for as long as there is new people, new blood coming into the scene, it's not going to, as long as like you said about tax, as long as like nothing horrific happens with regards internal combustion,
the government literally taxing you off the road or banning
basically
all diesel based vehicles or whatever, which emission zones.
But I think there would be such a massive outcry from the community when that happens. It'll be interesting to see how it does evolve, and no one knows. That's one thing we can't agree. We can say that, you know, parts pile become better because the cars are more valuable, and that's kind of a given, but with that it's a complete unknown, isn't it? We just don't.
And the value of the industry, I would imagine, is a lot bigger than we think it is. I'd imagine if you sat down and worked out how much money people spend on Land Rover Defenders across the board.
Yes, exclude any of the other Land Rovers, but if you were to look at Series and Defenders, what is that worth to the global economy? I think it would be in a vast number, even though they've been out of production for 10 years.
Yeah.
We look at, you know, from our own, you know, selfish point of view, our magazine and the entire events business aspect of it and what it does for us and our, you know.
And with the greatest respect, that's one publication. Yes, okay, you mean for a while, but it's a UK-based publication.
Yeah.
And people go, oh, it's really niche. But actually, you have a look at the outreach of that.
But look at, you know, when we put on an event, and all of those other traders benefit from all of those lovely visitors that come, you know, even a spares day next week, you know, the amount of money that will change hands throughout that, kind of someone buying that elusive part for 30 quid, multiply that over 150, 200 traders, and in Newbury, 800 traders. Oh my God, it's colossal.
But you know,
that's just that little bit, that snippet.
But I mean, the one thing that will happen is, you know, rebuild, the levels of rebuilds, etc. You can't buy a new Defender. So actually, people that do want to stay with that, you will have, I think that will grow. I think that will continue to grow. You know, professional, large restoration. Not necessarily like twisted with retro mods, because they do that very nicely, but I mean just standard rebuilds. I think that will grow and grow and grow, because people are willing to put in good money to.
There's a number of companies out there that, you know, we've all seen that will, you know, refurb and send out to the US, where there's a significant market for them still. And if my dad was still alive and I said to him that someone was paying $250,000 for a 110 station wagon, I probably would get a clip man here and go, I'll do some gardening. Because we never would imagine that was going to happen. You'd never got in a Land Rover Defender in 2016 and thought, you know, in 10 years' time, this, you know, one of these cars is going to be torn down and modernised to a degree, to the extent they can be, you know, to go over there, and be $250,000. I never thought that it would ever happen.
But yeah, I mean, I still, my enthusiasm is still as much as it ever was. Classic, as I say, I popped over there the other day when I bumped into to Mike, and they had a British Racing Green 110 V8 Works station wagon in the showroom, and I was like, oh, they are lovely. They are lovely.
If you ever get the chance, I think you have to make an appointment to go to Classic, don't you?
You can't just
pop in, but do. It's so worth it. Or you can book a tour.
Yeah, they do tours, and then you can have a look at the cars being built. But it's, like you say, you know, things have changed dramatically in those 10 years. You know, £250,000 Defenders. That's what they are, and you can see them for sale in the States, you can see them for sale within Europe. You know, there's a number of companies and Land Rover themselves, and you know, if someone had said that 10 years ago, you'd laugh at them.
I remember probably
12, 13 years ago, I remember a company down in Berkshire where I think we featured it in the mag, but it was the first Defender that we knew of that was £100,000, like a rebuild. And we had to go and see this thing. It's £100,000. I left thinking, that is absolute madness. And now that doesn't seem a bargain, because I'm not in that thing.
No. I mean, I think there are quite a few readers and listeners who you know, are probably have a portfolio of cars that have probably spent that much on a Defender. You know, it's not unusual, is it?
But at the same time, it's important to emphasise that now that the madness of COVID's died down and people actually have to work for a living and don't have tons of spare cash from being furloughed, Defender's prices from an attainable enthusiast level have softened.
They've settled down.
Which is good.
Yeah, they went absolutely balmy and they've settled down to a level. They're all strong money, but they will keep their money. So if you spend £20,000 on a Defender, or £15,000 on a Defender, it'll probably be worth that all day long, providing, as you said earlier, maintenance, keep on top of it. You know, there are far, worse places to put your money.
100%. Yeah, definitely.
I think with the, you were saying about the £100,000 Defenders, and obviously with the used parts, I think it's Arconic purchased a few years ago. I just remember this image where they purchased a load of 110 station wagons from Greece. So left-hand drive, rust-free. And again, it's going back to this moment where it was worthwhile for that company to go to Greece and source, I think it was 12, it was quite a few 110 station wagons to remanufacture to go to the US, because they were 200 TDIs. They had all the boxes ticked. And then what they did was obviously brought them back into the UK, and the doors were not good enough to be $100,000 or $200,000 vehicles. So they would then have big auto jumbles at the weekend at their yard, and they would sell off all these not good enough parts, but to everyone else we went
bang in. Yeah,
that's perfect, that's great. And they just kept the recycling thing going, where they understandably fitted new parts because you'd expect it for that value and for the quality product they produce. But they would then have a big auto jumble at the weekends where they'd have these rust-free doors from Greece, and they weren't a lot of money looking back at it now.
That's good
stuff. If only you could turn the clock back. Hindsight is a wonderful thing, but
I wouldn't have gone down the A421 last July.
or perhaps you should have done, because now you've...
It's better than ever now.
and you may not have owned that Land Rover now. It may have gone. You may have been tempted to sell it.
Funny enough, if I hadn't had that slight hiccup in it, it probably would have gone to America by now.
And now it's probably going to stay with you. So that's probably done you a favour.
Well, apart from I still have my mortgage to pay, Steve. It was always going to pay my mortgage on it. That's a crazy thing. That's 10 years. I purchased that car 10 years ago, and I purchased it with the anticipation that in 10 years' time, it was going to go up in value enough to pay my mortgage off. I mean, how many cars could you buy on that safe? You know, in thinking 10 years, it's going to go up that amount of money. Quite a lot. And you could pay my mortgage off.
Yeah.
Either way, I now have a mortgage and I have a leaky old Land Rover.
Oh, it's a Land Rover. A Land Rover that got me into a mortgage, because I sold that 110 I was talking about that I owned when I was at the main dealer would have sold to get the TDCI. Mm. I sold that to a company that sent it to America, and I got what I thought was a fair price for it. And I think it went abroad for $65,000 or something like that.
Yeah, that was a time when things were, even in America, it was quite crazy for them over there.
Yeah. Anyway, we should probably start wrapping up, because I think we're well over an hour already.
Are we?
I think so. But we can't go without saying that a new issue of Land Rover Monthly is on sale today. Here it is, the March issue. For the sake of listeners at home, I'm showing a picture of the cover to everyone on the salmon sofa. And it's
that's an amazing looking 322.
Very cool Range Rover L322, which I know Steve's been salivating over already.
when we get, I'll give you a little insight. Right? So when we get like, the next cover car comes in, that all the photos tend to go in like an internal storage system.
Yeah.
And because I knew what it was going to be, I was pouring over those photos, like often open photos, and what a car.
It is wicked, isn't it? So keep an eye on our socials today, because there'll be a bit of a teaser on there on Facebook and Instagram. And of course, we've told you all about it on here, and we'll be dropping more teasers over the next few weeks on the podcast as well. Not only do you get Land Rover Monthly this month, though, you get Land Rover Life, and it's a restoration special, as if it's going to be more relevant to what we've been talking about today. Loads of information about how you can get stuck in with your Land Rover project, how not to fail, how not to lose momentum and enthusiasm. It's all in here. So
I know someone that needs to read that.
Yeah, you.
Yeah, me.
cracking combo deal. Really? As I say, keep an eye on socials, because we'll be dropping more little teasers and hints about what you get in this month's fine collection of Land Rover content. Rush out and buy it, or sign up and subscribe. You'll save money and you'll get it delivered sooner than it arrives in the shops.
I've got something to add, actually.
Go on.
Subscribers.
Oh, yes.
So recently, as you guys probably know as well, we've run a campaign with a limited edition model.
Mm.
It's been hugely successful. We have a handful left, So if you've just recently come on board as a subscriber, thank you very much and welcome, because, you know, without you guys, we can't sit here and do this, can we?
Definitely. Yeah, it's a cracking thing. And like Steve says, we have actually found a few more down the back of the sofa. So if you thought you'd missed out on the model sets...
Salmon sofa?
Not the salmon sofa.
Oh, this doesn't round the back of this.
This is
another sofa.
One-piece design. Yes, we have got a few left in stock, but you'll have to be quick because they are selling quickly. Like I say, up to Christmas, they flew off the shelves, didn't they? We've got a few left of the 250. They're all numbered, limited edition models. So head to the landrovermonthly.co.uk, click on subscriptions, and that deal is still on there, so you can take advantage of it. Other than that, follow Steve on social media.
Steve Miller Automotive.
I'm Land Rover Martin.
I'm at my Prima Grey 90.
Yeah, you can see lots of pictures of Greg's lovely Defender. And Ian.
Instagram, I'm Ian_ArthurUK.
There you go.
And actually, that's a good quick point, actually. Quick plug, because you're from another podcast.
Yes, of course.
We've not even mentioned this.
Yeah, A Pint of Petrol, should you wish to entertain yourself for half an hour every Sunday morning with myself and our team waffling on about anything automotive. And usually me having a rant about LED headlights. It's my favourite rant at the minute.
It's a great listen. And
I haven't listened to your latest rant about them.
Should we go to the pub and I can rant about
it?
Yeah, I'm in my pint. So.
Yeah, that's true. It's about lunchtime, isn't it?
Well, Martin's buying, so don't worry.
Oh, even better.
Yeah, yeah.
Happy days. Right, well, thank you ever so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.